It is Saturday, October 24th, 2009, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. It's time now for GeekSpeak.
The bandwidth for GeekSpeak.org is provided by GNI, GNIHosting.com.
Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. This is Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the KUSP air room with me are Miles Elam. He's a slacker. And what else are you, Miles?
Student.
Okay. All right. Good enough.
Your employee.
That's right. You work for me. That's amazing. How many jobs now have we done this with? You've been my boss 3 or 4 times and so on?
No, I think I've only been your boss once. Boss twice.
Yeah, we've been coworkers a few times.
Yeah.
We never do anything effective together, though. Except for geeks.
Yeah, we have nothing to show for it.
No. Except for geeks. And the current job. It hasn't gone under. So in any case, we also have Ben Jaffe. He's a freelance media guy.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing, Ben?
I'm fantastic. I just got over being sick. I was really upset because probably 2 days ago, my voice was at least half an octave deeper than
it's
this.
It's still kind of deep.
It's still kind of deep. I really wanted to come in and say, you know, good morning. And like morning. Rattle everyone's car doors, you know?
You got to get really close to the microphone.
Hey, baby.
Hey, baby.
Hey, baby.
You're listening to Smooth Jazz 98. That was Kenny G.
Yeah.
Moving on.
All right. Al Luckow is also here. Hi, Al.
Hey, everybody.
And Al's a new media architect, which is so classy and cool.
Yeah. I made that up years ago.
And now everybody's using it.
Actually, somebody else said they liked it.
But
it,
I'm a new media architect as well, by the
what?
Way.
What? I'm a new media architect.
What's going on around here?
You might have been the first, but now it's meaningless.
Yep.
Ben, tell us what's going on in the Kindle world.
The Kindle world is a very, very interesting world. Kindle recently dropped their prices. Why, you might ask? Because they now actually have some very, very interesting competition. So Barnes & Noble has released the Nook, which I find to be kind of a funny name. I mean, it's a perfectly valid name, but it seems a little bit weird. I don't know. Anyway, well, the Barnes & Noble Nook is basically a Kindle, but in most people's opinion so far, having not actually seen or touched them, much better. It actually has a touchscreen now, not just one of those, what are they called, the screens? The ones that don't take power to display.
Right. But
I don't remember what they're called. Anyway.
Paper.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like paper display technology.
What we're talking about is the Kindle, the reader by Amazon. Actually, when it has no power, it can still have an image on its screen.
So yeah, yeah.
It only changes the state of the screen.
Yeah, it only takes power when it changes the screen.
Right.
Well, the Barnes & Noble Nook also has that, but it also is a touch screen, and it's kind of reminiscent of CoverFlow, and it's got a little menu thing. And
Is it for sale already?
It looks pretty cool. It will be on sale in November.
So it's a bit of virtual.
Yes, some people, all the people who have had their hands on it, who have written about it, have said it's very, very cool. It definitely looks, in my opinion, much sleeker and, you know, prettier than the Kindle. So anyway, we'll see. And then of course the other difference between another big difference between the Kindle and the Barnes & Noble Nook is that the Nook will be in stores, because Barnes & Noble has stores all over the United States and
a real
everywhere.
Place.
Yeah, yeah.
Amazon doesn't have real places.
Exactly. Amazon is in the cloud, whatever that means, right? So you have to order a Kindle and then have it shipped to you. So
are they about the same price? I mean, I don't know how much these
they're the are. Exact same price
what
right
they
now.
What do they cost? A couple hundred?
Like $250-ish.
Oh, gosh.
They're expensive. Book. Yeah, I mean, if you want to really recoup the cost of books, I mean, it's probably not going to happen. I kind of did the math because I was thinking about getting one. Because
and you only buy a book a year, so, and that's if someone gives it to you, really. So yeah,
No. I use libraries. Libraries are very... Oh, the other thing about the Nook is that you can now assuming this works as advertised, you can borrow your friend's books digitally. Borrow your friend's books with the Nook. You can't do that with a Kindle. So, kind of a neat idea.
Yeah.
Right. And then the other thing I want to briefly mention is there is now going to be another competitor to the iPhone, which looks to be actually a little bit more promising. It's Verizon and Motorola are coming out with what's called the Droid phone, which is based on the Android platform by Google. I don't know. We'll see what comes with that. So, you know, there's a couple of companies that have been sitting very comfortably are now going to have some competition.
Good. Thank you very much, Ben. Miles, what's going on with elections? It seems like nothing is, but you have an election story, so I'm extremely curious.
Well, you want to deal with some things before the election occurs rather
like
than waiting
and organizing?
Yes. In this case, it's an announcement of the nation's first open source election software. And this is being coordinated by a group of people, one of them being a consortium, the Open Source Digital Voting Foundation, which is the source code for, which has provided the source code for this, so that people can look at it and see what does this do, how does it react, does it follow the standards, and the like. And this is actually coming on the heels of Sequoia Data Systems, I believe is the name of the voting machine manufacturer, where they sent out through a information request some of their source code, but they didn't redact everything that they were expecting. So it's the first look at a proprietary system, and it turns out they may have violated those standards that are required for electronic voting machines.
Really? So you're saying there's for electronic voting machines, there are actually standards on how you can do the software?
Right. You can't have, for example, executable code held in the database so that it reads from the database and starts running the code that's in there, because you don't want the code to be manipulable
From a data
while the system is in use. So you can store data and retrieve data, but you can't actually have executable code or scripting language in there.
Right. And so it looks like they were.
It looked like they were.
Interesting.
But there was no way to find out.
Because it's a closed
system. Because it was a closed system. They were saying it's a trade secret, so we're not going to share it. And that's a bad thing for elections, because you want to see how the process works.
You want as much transparency as possible in elections.
Right. Exactly. And, I mean, one of the things that's extremely transparent is a pen and a piece of paper and a ballot.
Well, not all paper is transparent. Sorry, go on.
Okay. So what this group is doing is spearheading an initiative to have this open source software that you can then put onto some device to actually work toward a fully transparent system that can be audited.
Cool. And is it, I'm assuming it's a beta thing. Is there any hardware vendor that's actually going to use this software? Or is it kind of a moving target at this point?
The idea is that it's not targeted for a specific hardware. It's targeted for, you know, a generic touchscreen interface. So you make your touchscreen work with you know, that software, or a generic, you know, storage device to store all of the vote casting.
Cool. Thank you very much. You know, I was taking photographs when I was in D.C. Last week of a whole bunch of night scenes and having fun with my 200 ISO and then switching up to like 1600 ISO. But Al, you were telling me about a new camera from Nikon. I've got Nikon as well.
Yeah.
It's doing a little bit better or different kind of ISO solutions.
Yeah. It's the
ISO is a standard that has to do with sensor quality. So we used to talk about ISO with film and how fast you could expose the film, basically, is what ISO is.
So the higher the ISO number, the darker it can be when you take a picture. If you take a picture at ISO 100, then it's got to be kind of bright, but you're going to have a nice even photo that's got a real tight grain. If you pump up your ISO to, say, 1,000, then you're going to be able to take a picture in a darker area, but it's going to probably be a little bit grainy. Nikon has come out with a new camera. It's called the D3S, and it is their ISO number is 102,400.
So you can take pictures in blackness?
They're saying you can take pictures of stuff you can't even see with a naked eye. So it's a pro-level DSLR, it's going to be kind of costly.
And it's big.
It's a big camera. It's not like one of the little point-and-shoot things. It's got a lens on it, just like a lot of the, you know, it's like a normal camera with interchangeable lenses and things like that. But that ISO is ridiculous. I mean, 102,000?
I'm curious how that would work, because the human eye is actually pretty good at detecting even just a few photons.
Yeah, this is better.
I don't know. I don't think they have any human parts in this thing, but it does. That is
pretty. No, but I mean, like, the human eye can detect only like 3 photons coming in, sometimes even fewer. So I don't understand how this would be able to see. If the photons aren't there, then how do you perceive it better.
It looks at exophotons.
One of the cool things about this is that it also works in movie mode. DSLRs all are having this HD movie mode. A lot of them have movie mode. And what's really cool about that is you can change the lenses. And so being able to change a lens on a digital movie camera is pretty high-end. I mean, even if it's on one of these cameras, you still can get a lot of effects, you know, depth of field, things like that. So this ISO quality also works in movie mode.
Wow.
The Nikon has a 720p HD, so it's...
So this one they haven't increased?
They haven't increased it. The Canon, there is a Canon coming out that also has a very high ISO. I don't have the number on that. I don't think they've really said exactly. I don't think it's as high as the Nikon, but it's also another super high ISO sensitivity. And they have 1080p. So they're kind of coming out ahead
We're talking about video for these digital SLRs. An SLR is a single lens reflex. It's a camera like who's Superman's photographer?
Jimmy Olsen.
Jimmy Olsen uses, right? Or Spider-Man uses when he's. In any case, the ISO thing, Miles, about the human eye. We can't form pictures in real. There's a lot more photons. Going
yeah,
in the
I guess there's
room.
Also the shutter speeds. You can leave the exposure for longer. And
right, you can
also
build a picture over a millisecond.
How big the lens is, amount of light.
But the human eye, being able to capture it, it's really when it's in complete blackness whether it gets detected. It's not necessarily the brain actually processes it either. We see more than we can actually understand. So I don't think that you. I mean,
that happened a lot to me in math.
Yeah.
Yeah. In math class, I saw a lot more than I could understand.
So I don't think, we don't have that good a night vision compared to like night vision goggles.
Right. Except night vision goggles aren't perceiving in the visible spectrum.
Sometimes they are, but you're right. Lots of times they have an infrared or an ultraviolet light on the top of it. Yeah.
Well, reports on this camera are that it actually does a pretty good job. It does get somewhat grainier as you pump up that ISO, and people start to look a little bit more like zombies.
Of course, it's not really grainy. It's more like, it's more noisy.
Noisy, that's yeah. Really noisy is a better word, yeah. Grain is left over from the film.
Right, in the film thing, it really was that each kind of cell of coloring change was larger, mm-hmm. and therefore more photons hit that cell and changed it, so the actual pixels, if you were bigger.
Yep.
In a camera, it's more like there's a lot more.
It's noise is what you'd call it, yeah.
And that's why it has a different effect, unfortunately.
Photographing in the dark.
Thank you very much for that. Ben, space?
Space.
You should do the deep voice.
Space. Yeah.
And moving on. Miles?
That's all. I just wanted to mention space.
You just wanted to mention space.
Because I always do. No. Okay, so I want to talk briefly about exoplanets. So we are discovering exoplanets up the wazoo. There are two ways we discover exoplanets.
This is a family show.
Yeah.
Go on.
Up the wazoo, up the kazoo. So we discover them by looking at the difference in light output as planets occlude stars. That's the Kepler mission that I've been talking about. And then we also look at star wobble. So as a planet goes around a star, it pulls the star around with it, kind of. The star actually kind of offsets the movement of the planet. And we can look at the Doppler shift on a spectrograph of the star's emission lines, and see how much that's shifting. And therefore, we can figure out how much it's wobbling. And therefore, we can figure out information about the planet. The Geneva Observatory in Chile has discovered now 2 to the 5th new exoplanets, just to be geeky about it.
32 of them?
32. Okay. 32 new exoplanets, which puts the number that we've discovered somewhere around 400. I don't have the exact number.
Are any of these things, any of them have liquid water? we in the realm?
We covered
this one. What was that one that was like?
We covered the one that's
basically
vaporizing
liquid
rocks, right, which would then precipitate
rain down
into these lakes of lava.
Are any of these hundreds of exoplanets in a space where it's not completely solid water? It's just water on it, and it's not vaporizing rock.
Well, I mean, we can only tell so much about them. We have discovered actually 28 what we have named super Earths, which have maybe a mass of a few times that of Earth.
Oh, that's not bad for mass. Yeah.
Yeah, actually, 24 of them were discovered by this observatory, or rather by the particular instrument, the high accuracy.
But they're 7 feet from their sun, from the star. It's the right size, yay!
Anyway, it's pretty cool. But something I didn't know about this, so they have this instrument that they've been using called the High Accuracy Radial Velocity Planet Searcher, which is a pretty cool name for an instrument, HARPS, H-A-R-P-S. And so it uses that radial velocity method of looking at the star wobble. What I didn't know is that they can actually resolve Doppler shifts so that they can actually discern movements that are as small as 3.5 kilometers per hour. So that means that, wow. I guess, if you were to somehow adapt this to looking at people walking, if you were standing still and then you were walking forward, just by the Doppler shift in light, it would be able to...
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's so cool.
The Doppler shift, if anyone's ever been on the side of a road and they've seen an ambulance pass by and the ambulance driving really fast, you'll hear it higher pitch as it comes towards you and lower. Yeah, it's a little hard on the siren because the siren itself is doing that.
Like that.
And when it leaves you, it goes lower pitch. And the basic idea is that its sound source, when it's coming towards you, the speed at which it's traveling is actually making the frequency higher. So instead of its boo, it's going to go boo because it's going faster towards you. And as it passes you, it's going to extensively slow down, or not really slow down, decrease the frequency of the sound.
You hear
so
that
with lower pitch.
You hear that with the speed racers in Star Wars, like that, where the pitch actually goes down, right? Not only does the rate of the go down, but also the pitch itself goes down.
Right. So anyway, that is a Doppler effect and happens with light.
So that's just so cool.
I didn't know it was so detailed.
Constantly blown away with...
So what that means when you talk about the wobble, really, is that you're looking at the Doppler shift as the planet goes in front of the sun versus behind the sun. And, of course, the sun actually gets moved a little bit by that planet.
Exactly.
We're not talking very much, though.
Yeah, and when I first heard about the star wobble mechanism, or the mechanism of detecting things way back when, I had assumed, oh, the star is moving left and right, and we're resolving the star move to the left and to the right, which didn't make much sense to me considering the images that we have of stars really are not that great, you know?
Right,
so it would
right.
be like within many, many, like very, very small fraction of a pixel kind of thing. But it turns out that they're actually, you know, looking at the spectrographs. And
very cool science. Thank you very much.
Doppler shift. Woo. Yeah.
Thank you very much for that great science. And now for something completely ridiculous, Miles.
Yes, we've all heard about the balloon boy, or rather the balloon that had no boy. But I wanted to take a more geeky look at that news story, and I actually want to take some aim at the news organizations that were covering it and plastering.
Really? No, they did a great job.
Yeah. Well, in fairness, they wouldn't have known whether or not the boy was in there. That's fine. Except they could have figured out, let's see, we have this balloon. It's of this size, and it obviously wasn't fully inflated. Like, it had that wobble in it. So
even if it was fully inflated.
That... it's not going to carry a boy of the size of Falcon.
You mean, like, because of the amount of air displacement?
Right.
Right.
The buoyancy in air is what we're talking about. It's the same principle that you would have with having a ship in water, is that it's displacing that amount of water. Its mass is less than the equivalent amount of water, therefore it stays.
Oh, it's perfectly clear. I even understood what you're talking about. You totally lost me.
I'm sorry.
But let's do it slower, because that buoyancy thing is a really good perspective. You can't just pump more helium and have it lift more, right? You actually have to, basically, you have to make a pocket out of air and say, I'm going to push away this much air, and therefore the amount of air that would normally be there, that will be the amount of uplift that I'll have. So that percentage is not very large. Like, you have to have a lot of displacement. That's why blimps are so big. It has to displace a lot of air to carry a load that's efficient.
Right.
Now, so what you're saying is that you could have just said, well, that's about, I don't know, 5 feet wide. Can it lift a person?
Right. But there's also that, so where are you getting this helium? Because if you go to a grocery store, like for like a party shop, and that has about 250 cubic feet of helium, that will lift 17 pounds.
250 cubic feet.
And under
pounds.
Optimum
okay.
conditions.
All right.
Under optimum, I mean, there's no leakage. You don't mess up anywhere. The material that you're using is as light as possible.
Right. Because you're going to, well, the material itself is going to weigh something.
Right. When you fill up a balloon with helium, the balloon has mass. So you have to overcome that as well.
So nobody bothered to do the math before reporting on this story.
Well, then they were saying, oh, I hope he's going to be okay. Let's assume that he was in the balloon.
Okay.
You can't breathe helium and survive for, you know, a half an hour.
You'd sound like, really funny at
it's
first.
It's not oxygen.
Then,
or it's not the nitrogen oxygen mix that we have.
I think you could probably survive with a helium oxygen mix.
You would survive in a helium environment. I'm sure you would survive somewhere along the lines of where you would survive if you were holding your breath,
right?
Because you don't have, you know, the materials you would need for respiration. So they're talking about, oh, we need to get this balloon down so that we can save him. How long has the balloon been up there? No, seriously. Like, why weren't none of these questions were asked when I was watching the news footage? None of them were asked.
No, I haven't even seen footage of this thing. I was totally focused on other things.
I saw footage and then I left. I didn't really want to watch
it. Like, ignore it.
But this was captivating, you know, the nation. I mean, it was wall-to-wall coverage among all the stations, but no one asked the questions that are basic physics.
Stupidity can be captivating.
This is why you listen to Geek Speak, right?
Yes.
If only we were alive, if we were only we did live coverage of it, you know?
Yeah, that would be silly.
Yeah.
I'd be embarrassed if I was a news, you know, company that just had this on there. It's like, did anybody do any research at all? Or are you just trying to jump on the most, you know, bizarre thing you can find?
To quote Jon Stewart, it's like, how do we get the numbers? How about all that bank of people that you have behind the reporters that are sitting in those computers? Like, couldn't they look that up?
That's just a video loop.
All right.
Those people are old.
Thank you very much for the frustration on news coverage or science stories. Al, what can Wi-Fi do for us?
Well, we know that Wi-Fi is what allows us to go into the coffee shop and open up our laptop and be able to access the internet.
And listen to this fine program.
Yes.
Podcasts.
If you're listening through the web.
Hundreds of episodes at your disposal.
You can do all that stuff. Well, there's another thing. University of Utah has been working with Wi-Fi for other purposes. What they can do is by measuring the resistance to the radio waves that are transmitting wireless signals, scientists can monitor whether or not someone is in a room or where they are within the room. So what that means is what they're working towards is being able to just say, okay, well, this house, there's people in this house. Let's just stick a couple antennas here. And by using those, they can then tell where the person is within the house and where they're moving. So obviously, if like somebody's in the hostage situation, they can see where the people are.
Mm-hmm.
But they're trying to get this so that it's going to be able to work through Wi-Fi. So if you have Wi-Fi running around, you know, you can just like, you know, connect into it and then see where the people are in the house and where they're moving. And
what we're basically talking about, we talk a lot about Wi-Fi. People call and go, I can't work in this part of the house. And we say, well, the microwave's in the way, or if there's a wall in the way, there's a lot of metal in it. There's a lot of things that interfere with Wi-Fi. In fact, even the human body does, because you've got water in it. It's kind of dense and it's going to affect electromagnetic spectrum. And so what these researchers are doing are using a whole bunch of Wi-Fi. They do a lot of Wi-Fi points, like one every, you know, meter or so surrounding a house. Mm-hmm. And then from that, they look at all the data coming in from these Wi-Fi signals. And as they decrease in frequency or intensity, they know that something was there. And by triangulating multiples, they can draw a pretty good picture of what's happening in that space.
Mm-hmm.
So that idea has been around for a long time. The thing that's interesting is that these Wi-Fi points that this guy's using are cheap. Like, you could just set these things up.
It's nothing. Yeah.
And then really, when it comes down to it, the reason why it's easier to do it in a grid format is the software's easy to develop and the algorithmic stuff is simpler. But if you get less points and you get smarter software, you theoretically, with just your neighborhood Wi-Fi, could do the same kind of thing pretty effectively.
So you kind of have to be moving, because it really only senses the motion.
The change.
Change, the difference. And it can't actually generate a picture.
Right, more like like a heat blob, it looks like.
Right,
on the videos.
So if you're...
We had
like
some great videos up on geekspeak.org.
Thinking about setting it up near the shower and for your neighbor, it's not...
No, it won't be like
make
that.
It, but...
You know, I did get a scan, the through the clothing scan when I was traveling. have you seen these new scanning devices? We talked about it years ago on Geekspeak, but basically it's a ultrasonic scanner that goes through clothing and stuff, and basically someone in some room is seeing a picture of your body naked.
Really?
And so I stood in that thing and they scanned me, and I'm like, oh, someone's checking me out.
Huh.
I felt really proud.
Wow.
Any case, thank you, Al, for that. Sorry. GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in digital technology. Well, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry, using digital technology for less radiation and offering one-appointment crowns and veneers. For more appointments and information, 423-2447. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are Miles Elam, Ben Jaffe, and Al Luckow. We're covering the geek news today, but we will take your calls with questions and comments about technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800. Again, that's 476-2800. Toll free at 1-800-655-4800. 1-800-655-5877. That's toll-free at 1-800-655-KUSP. And of course, you can send us email right now by going to geekspeak.org and filling out a little form so we can reduce the amount of spam that we get. So call us up, ask us questions, email us, ask us questions, participate in our forums. We're here for you all the time with technology. And I'm going to move on to news as we're waiting for that to come about. Ben, go on.
Oh, yes.
I guess I could give you a lead. There are a lot of particles and materials in the world, and the fundamentals we call elements. And Ben has some information about a new element. No? Did I ruin it for you?
I don't know about that segue.
All right, go on.
I want one of those. Anyway, I want a segue.
Wait. Oh, gosh, we didn't do the podcast mention. Every week we're supposed to do a podcast. Ben, you've got the podcast.
Oh, okay, this is off the cuff, but Astronomy Cast is fantastic.
What do they talk about on the podcast that's named Astronomy Cast?
Science in general, some political... No, they talk about astronomy. And it is an absolutely fantastic podcast, and I'm doing it off the cuff, so I don't have anything prepared to say about them. But, yeah, it's these two people. One of them is an astronomer. I can't remember her exact title. Pamela Gay, and then I can't remember the other guy. But anyway.
Anyway, good podcast.
But I do listen to it frequently, and they always have very, very good explanations of astronomy news. Also, I just recently listened to one of their podcasts was about finding dark places to observe the stars. And after that podcast, I was I decided that I had to go do that. And so I'm kind of trying to figure out when I'm going to find time to go star watching because it's been a while. And everyone needs some star watching. Anyway, but about elements. So element 114, and this is slightly late news. It came out on Physics Today on the 20th of September, so about a month ago. But yeah, it looks like element 114, which was discovered in Russia about 10 years ago at the Joint Institute for Nuclear Research, it turns out that it has been verified.
Oh, good.
In Berkeley. So I just thought I'd mention that because it's probably a couple miles from my house.
This is that one that lasts for like no time at all, right?
I'm sure it has a very, very...
Yeah, where can I get some of that?
I don't know about that. I'm sorry. So anyway, element 114.
What's its name? Does it have a name yet?
It does. Oh, I have it right here. Where is it? Oh, Ununquadium.
Ununquadium.
Yeah. Oh, that brings me to another point, which I didn't know if I was going to bring up briefly. I just want to say what my favorite element is, which is it used to be unananium, UUU, because it's called unananium. I don't know if there are any other listeners who love that element as much as I do. It has a half-life of 4 seconds or less, and in 2004, I'm very dismayed to find that in 2004 it was renamed from unananium, which makes it now not my favorite element anymore. Now it's like roentgium. Roentgium. Yeah.
Roentgium. Ben, what's your favorite planet?
My favorite
celestial body.
What's the highest prime number I can think of? my favorite.
I like Earth.
You're up at. Now I'm going to mispronounce it.
The one that's shaped like a walnut.
Yeah.
I love that one.
Oh my gosh.
Say it in a minute. I'm sorry to put you on the spot. All right.
Yeah, you put me on the spot. It's Europida or something like that.
All right.
It's a fantastic body.
Miles, what does ZFS stand for? Thank you, Ben.
Zettabyte file system.
What the heck is that?
Zettabyte is a very, very large number. It's actually... Well, it's larger than anything that we can imagine. Let's just leave it there. Think of a terabyte hard drive. Now think of each terabyte hard drive as being a byte.
Okay.
And you're getting close.
All right. It's a lot. It's a lot of space. So what is the ZFS file system? File system is the way a hard drive stores data.
Right. On a Windows machine, most of the time you have NTFS or FAT32. On a Mac, you have HFS+. So for in a Solaris system or Open Solaris and some FreeBSD systems, you have ZFS. And the thing behind this file system is that it allows for a great amount of flexibility. I don't want to go too much into detail because...
But some ideas on it are really interesting, like the idea that you can look at a collection of files as one file and you can actually think of a file instead of like take a Word document. This is a bad example because it wouldn't really work this way. But take a Word document that has headlines. You could theoretically, in the ZFS file system, you could assume that one of those blocks would actually be a file. So you could look at the whole thing as a collection, or you could look at parts of it as individual files. Okay, now you're looking confused.
Are we
confused.
Talking about the same thing?
I thought that that was one of the things it could do.
No, I don't think so. ZFS, one of the big things about it is that it does checks to make sure that the data is valid.
Okay.
So if you write some data to your hard drive, many times we assume like, oh, it's okay. But there's a lot of chance for silent data corruption. In other words, something goes wrong with the hard drive, the head goes the wrong way, or just, you know, cosmic ray hits something and, you know, flips a bit.
The ultimate scapegoat.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you may open up that Word document, and the worst that happens is like one letter is reversed. But you won't know that. Right. But ZFS, you can, because it does a check, makes a signature, as it were, of the file when it saves it, so that when it's reading it back, if it doesn't match the signature, you know, oh, wait, something was wrong here.
Okay.
And so it checks that on the fly. And it has a lot of other really cool features,
real
like
robust.
Snapshotting. But the issue at hand is that Apple was talking about including ZFS in their server application inside OS X server, and then presumably later on OS X desktop. And it's ZFS is a much better file system than HFS Plus, which is now showing its age. It's 10 or 15 years old now.
Mm-hmm.
But now Apple has announced the ZFS project is over.
Oh, why?
And we kind of saw this from Snow Leopard, because it had less support for ZFS than Leopard did. And there's, as is typical with Apple, we don't know exactly why. There's a lot of conjecture out there saying, well, it might be because they had ran into some technical problems, or it may be because there's an ongoing patent lawsuit from NetApp about it, or it could just be, you know, they don't trust Oracle because Oracle just bought Sun, and they don't know what the future of the technology is going to be.
Interesting. So a lot of speculation, but no improvements to the file system. So therefore, we don't know what Apple's going to do as HFS gets replaced.
They're hiring file system developers.
Yeah.
So who knows? Maybe they're working on their own stuff. Maybe that's why they're doing it.
Well, thank you very much for that.
That's really depressing.
I think we're going to go ahead and take it. I don't think it's that depressing. Miles has been talking about ZFS for like years.
No. I was talking about a different file system.
Oh, what was the file system you were talking about? It was XML parsers.
Ricer 4.
Ricer 4. Oh, so sorry.
That was a bad call by me. That was wrong. The guy ended up.
Miles is very rarely wrong.
That sounds like a Star Trek world.
Riser 4.
That's
where I go for Riser.
How was I supposed to know that the programmer who was the lead developer of Riser was going to be convicted of murder?
Is that why I got killed?
Yes. That's why the project stopped.
You just can't know that stuff.
You can just guess. Every one in 10 programmers, I think.
That's true.
So we're going to take a call, because we can. From Santa Cruz, which is where we are, Lori, welcome to GeekSpeak. Oh, let me push this button. Hi. Welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi. Hi, this is Lori, and God bless the geeks. I'm so happy to talk to you. I am a returning student. My tech skills are, I have a steep learning curve.
Mm-hmm.
I am learning ArcGIS, GPS this semester, and I'm curious, the only way I can work from home if I'm not on the campus on the mainframe is if my teacher wants me to buy an external hard drive to be able to run the program, because it's like each raster model is 300 or 400 gigabytes. So now I need to buy an external hard drive. I've never done anything like that. Can you advise me?
Yes. All right. What kind of operating system are you running?
I have XP.
Okay. Basically, go to any store and buy one off the shelf. Anyone you buy, off the shelf at a store is going to be fine.
There's a pile of them on sale right now at Fry's.
Yeah.
At Fry's?
I would go ahead
and
get a cheap one.
You can get a terabyte.
Should I get a terabyte? Yeah, that's my question.
Oh, yeah. You could get,
they have 2 terabytes.
Yeah, well, you know what? Sometimes the 2 terabytes don't work on everybody's system. They have a 1.5 that is really stable, and they've got 1 terabytes. I was at the Micro Center a couple days ago, and they had a whole pile of them. They've got neat ones that are like really small, and they don't require power, so you can plug them in, and the power they get is from the USB that you so there's no like extra power plug. Or you can get a bigger one that has an external power plug that you have to find power for. Personally, I like the little ones where you can just sort of carry them around, and they're like, they're bigger than a wallet, but not too much bigger, a little bit longer.
That's what I want, because I drive, a lot. and I need to take it with me back and forth.
They also have ones that are like you can drop them. They've got like rubber cases.
Don't drop your hard drive.
They're what?
Don't drop your hard drive.
You shouldn't drop them. But if you do, they have these ones that they've got like they're yellow and they've got rubber around them. And you know when you go there, you'll be overwhelmed by the number of choices you have nowadays.
I already am.
Yeah.
But my question is, I'll go down to Fry's and look for one of those bounceable ones. But my question mainly is, like, how do I manage my data on my external hard drive?
Okay, well, hang on.
Because I've never done that before.
Hang on just 1 second. First off, let's not call those bounceable. Do not take a hard drive and bounce it. You will destroy it.
Public service announcement.
Public service announcement. Just because it looks like it's a toy, it's not.
Bad word.
No, it's okay. You did fine. I like the idea of it.
Maybe you should buy two, actually.
One way to ensure that no one can get your data off is by bouncing your hard drive.
You should only bounce your hard drive if you have two backups in place.
Right. So the question you have is, like, is this software – it's this software package. Like Arc, is it Arc Info, Editor, Viewer? Which one is it you're using?
It's the student edition, so it's Arc, GIS.
It's the data set.
The raster models and the data sets are huge.
They're
huge.
So I'm not real familiar with this application. I know a little bit about it, but I've never really run it. And so –
Oh, you geeks would love it.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, being able to look at data information about geography is very cool.
There's so much powerful information out there being collected now.
The basic idea, this is the kind of software package where you can say, okay, this is the city that I live in, and where are the sewer systems, and where are electrical systems, and where are people living? And all that data gets mapped in, and you can turn off layers and rearrange, and you can add data set to it.
Really, it's really amazing. Cool.
But in any case, these applications, because the large data set and the rasterized image you're talking about, basically the maps that aren't really vector, they're actually just giant pictures, really high quality pictures. Everyone knows, the software package knows that this is a big issue, and so they're going to look at it kind of like video editing software packages use, right? So you're going to install the software on your laptop, and then in the preferences of this thing, you'll be able to set where these files are and where your working directory is, and you just work on the hard drive. The one thing is
I just navigate to my external hard drive?
That's right.
And save things on that?
That's basically how it works. It's pretty easy.
Oh,
so when you copy things from the school or something, go and take your hard drive, put the stuff in the folder, and then you're going to be basically opening and referencing it. It might have like a library system. The software might have like a library system that manages these files, kind of like a media server. And let it do that. But this important part is to tell the software package where your storage is. And it's not going
to
be a problem.
And that means go to my computer, navigate to my external hard drive.
Yeah,
there'll
actually probably be a preference that says, cache or location, file location, library, whatever.
Okay.
And that's what you do. Yeah. That's pretty
simple.
Oh, wow.
You guys make it sound easy. So I'm hoping it is.
It will be. The only thing you're going to be concerned about is that you probably don't want to run the application when you don't have the hard drive connected. Kind of be prepared to do this.
Oh, totally. I can't even open ArcMap or ArcCatalog without the external hard drive at home.
Right.
I don't have enough memory at all to manipulate the data.
You might have more problems with your computer's performance, but
it's funny. Something that's coming up now is because we're getting into the terabyte, the 1.5, the 2 terabyte drives. There's so much data going onto a single disk.
I know.
I kind of want to say get a smaller version of the drive and buy two of them.
But then you got to deal with some software package that emulates, duplicates them.
Here's the thing: anytime
you get a lot of data, now the data you're dealing with is probably stuff you could download again. Think about it.
Yes.
The hard drive will fail. You will bounce it at one point, even without bouncing, the hard drive will fail. So remember that at every moment, if you don't have two copies of something, you're at risk of losing it. It's not like the physical world where you've got your book on the shelf. It's not
true.
Like that.
My advisor also said the same thing. So should I buy 2 1-terabyte hard drives?
Sure, that's a good solution. And then just make sure you duplicate it. And you can really duplicate it by just think of one as just a backup. You don't do anything but copy all the files from one to the other. There's also software packages that do that. I'm not real savvy on which on the Windows environment.
Well, thank you for all the advice.
Certainly.
I am so thrilled, and I listen to you guys all the time.
Well, thank you for listening.
Good luck looking at
city maps, okay?
Oh, you geeks would love it. It's more than that. I mean, it's like where the fish are on the planet. It's amazing. There's an amazing amount of data, and it's used all across all kinds of industries.
The thing is, I know where the fish are. They're in the water. Thank you, Laurie, very much for the call. Bye.
Bye.
If you'd like to call in with a question or comment about technology, the phone numbers are 476-2800. Toll free at 1-800-655-5877. That's 1-800-655-KUSP. And Rick Philman, our phone answer extraordinaire, is waiting to take your call and pump it into the air room. Al, hi.
Hi.
So you got a new car.
Well, I wish I had this car. You know, we've all seen cars that, oh, look, this car is driving around and now it's driving in the water. It's a car that goes on land and on water. And every time we see these, they look like a, basically a boat that has wheels on it. This guy, it's called the water car, the Python water car. And this guy, his name is David Hansen. Or not David Hansen. What is the guy's name? Well, I'll think of it in a second. Anyway, he builds these cars that are, they look like high-performance Corvettes and things like that. His name is Dave Marsh. And he has built these things since 1976 because he realized that the, a lot of the same materials that are going into building cool sports cars are going into boats. So why not just actually make a really nice sports car? And he's got cars that are, you know, they're high-performance cars. They've got, I think he is putting Corvette engines in them. But they can be driven on the water and on the land. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have a link on here, and but they are really, really cool-looking cars. I mean, they look like...
They look like high-performance sports cars.
They're just they're high-performance amphibious vehicles.
They don't look like a boat.
They, in the water, they can go in excess of 60 miles per hour.
Wow.
Which is fast for water. And on the street...
How many knots is that?
I don't know how many knots. I'm not really good. I have an iPhone app that does that, though. Right. It says a mid-second quarter-mile time. It can go 0 to 60 in 4.5 seconds on land. And the engine is based on the famous aluminum LS Corvette powertrain. So it's got
52.13 knots, by the way.
52.13 knots for you pirates out there. Mm-hmm. Arr, that's going fast. this is a really neat looking car. The wheels kind of retract. It gets to, you know, you drive up to the water. I think you just drive in, and then the wheels just kind of come up. And then you can drive around. It looks like a car, like a sports car, driving around on the water. And another one of the neat things about it is that if you decide, well, I'm going to open the door, and you're out in the middle of the lake, you just open the door because the buoyancy of the car is such that the water doesn't actually go in the door. The door is higher than the water, and it just you can just open it up and, you know, throw a fishing line out or whatever. These are really neat looking. They're pricey, but it's finally something that like. Now finally looks like a James Bond kind of cool thing. Yeah. You know, it's not like this like military duck that you go to Wisconsin
Dells.
Since
the 50s, we've always been fixated on the flying car.
Yeah.
But how much of our world is covered by water?
Like, right.
You got a point there. What would be really cool is like the first guy to like transcontinental drive or something across the... you know, between continents with one of these things. I mean, it looks like a car driving. It's a convertible, you know. It looks like a car just driving on the water. It's really a neat thing. It's called the water car. And we have video and links to video and all sorts of stuff on our site. So check it out.
All right. Thank you very much for the crazy car update. let's go ahead and take a call. What the heck, right?
Yeah.
We do those kind of things. From Santa Cruz, Mark, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi, guys. What a great show you're having this morning. I've got a problem with my Canon MX700 multi-copier scanner. Facts, not handshaking with my wife's Windows Vista laptop.
Okay.
I have a Dell. We have a two-wire. The initial problem was with showed up when I was on my Dell desktop computer. I printed something to the Canon, walked away from my, and it worked fine. Walked away for about an hour, came back, and then I tried to print something else, and it didn't print. So I called Canon the next day, and they went through a whole series of things and then threw up their hands and discussed and said, well, you know, all else has failed, so download drivers, and they guided me through doing that, and then it worked fine.
And did you put the drivers on your wife's machine, too?
My wife downloaded the drivers on her machine.
Okay.
But for some reason, it's not handshaking.
All right. Is this a USB printer or a network printer?
It's a USB printer.
Okay. So are you unplugging it from one computer and plugging it into the other computer to print it, or are you trying to do printer sharing?
I'm trying to do printer sharing. Okay. And also, my laptop doesn't... both of them used to work.
Right.
Before this happened.
Printer sharing is notoriously kind of difficult. Are you running XP on both your machines?
Vista on one and XP on the other.
Yeah, I think your wife's laptop needs to move around and go plug into this thing directly through USB to print. I know that's a bad solution, but what you're trying to do is this problem that multiple OSs communicate differently, and that, I think, is probably a problem. Upgrade both your machines to Vista. Maybe it'll fix it. Maybe not. But I think the simple solution, unfortunately, is to have the laptop to print just go and plug into it. I know that's not exactly great. The other thing you could do is you could just send documents to... Yeah, that's not great either.
That's what we've been doing, but it's a hassle.
Yeah, it's a hassle.
Yeah, I've never had good luck with the multi... I never buy the fax, scanner, printer thing. Every single one of them I've ever gotten has always given me some kind of issue like this.
Yeah.
You know, it's just... The multi-units just... They, for some reason, you know, I just get... I focus on a printer. It's either a printer or a fax machine. You get them... It sounds great when you get them all together, but it's just like anything. One thing breaks, the whole thing is
and
now...
You also get to make sure, is your network working? Can the laptop see you? You know, one's plugged into Ethernet and one's doing Wi-Fi. Can they see each other?
Say that again, please.
So the question I have is the laptop, her laptop, can she see your machine? Or is the network actually working effectively?
She's able to... get on the internet.
Okay, so one of the problems with home networks, you guys have a Wi-Fi and also plug-in? Are you both?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So the machine that plugs into the printer is plugged in through Ethernet, right? And then her computer uses Wi-Fi? Is that, I'm assuming?
Actually, the Canon is plugged into the back of my Dell desktop.
Right. So the desktop is plugged in, not using Wi-Fi, right? So sometimes they actually have different networks and they can't see each other. So you need to make sure that they can see each other first. The way you do that is from her machine, go ahead and browse the network and see if your Dell shows up. Also, make sure that I would turn off file print sharing on the Dell and turn it back on and try to get to see to make sure that it's there. You should be able to browse from the machine and see the shared printer. If you can't see the shared printer, it's a networking issue, right? It's a preference issue in that sense. So good luck with it, Mark. I don't think we can do much more than that, unfortunately, but good luck.
Sorry, you've been helpful. I really appreciate it. Have a great day.
Thank you so much. Bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, let's see. Water, okay, the water crawl is called the Python. You know the Python programming language is named after Monty Python? I found that out today.
Yes, really?
Wow.
You know, the project, one of the projects of that is codenamed Unladen Swallow.
Nice. Yeah, they use the terminology from it's all from in Monty there. Python, yeah.
I just watched The Holy Grail last night.
Really? Not for the first time.
No. Okay. For like the 200th time.
You know, last night I had some food and I went to sleep.
We had that on the guys' night out.
Oh.
We watched the totally Holy Grail.
Hey, it was like 9.5 hours ago that it ended. So it's recent.
Monty Python or Life of Brian? Which one do you like better? I mean, sorry, Holy Grail or
Meaning of Life.
Meaning of Life, thank you. Meaning of Life you like?
Life of Brian.
Life of Brian, yeah. I knew Miles would like Life of Brian. Life of Brian.
I'm very split. Yeah. I liked Spamalot. I saw Spamalot.
Have you ever seen any Star Trek?
They took me up on stage at Spamalot.
Really? Was it your birthday?
No.
Oh, man.
No, wow. But I was the one.
It's very cool. All right, let's move on to something else. What's going on in space? There's one more story that's kind of weird.
Yeah, it's definitely very weird. So NASA's Interstellar Boundary Explorer.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's a cool name. They come up with cool names, and they make good acronyms, too. IBEX. It's been making all sky maps, full sky maps of the heliosphere, which is this bubble of magnetism that extends from the sun far beyond Pluto. And it is kind of what deflects some of our cosmic rays. So the first one came back, and it turns out in the middle of this big map is a bright ribbon of unknown origin that's in this.
Is it traveling? Is it moving?
Now we don't know. Because it sounds reminiscent of something.
Does it produce euphoria?
I don't know.
Hmm.
So about this, it doesn't glow in the visible light spectrum. It's the source of energetic neutral atoms particles.
Wait, so there's just a long, like, weird ribbon
that's huge.
It's emanating particles.
It bisects the entire thing. You should see this picture of this all sky map. Comes all the way through. It's actually, it kind of moves, or it's going right between where we sent the Voyager 1 and the Voyager 2 spacecraft. So,
great.
Yeah, so they're not seeing.
So Voyager 1 is now sentient?
But yeah, so we're making another all-sky map right now to see if the ribbon is moving. And if you see some crazy gray-haired guy named Tolian Soren building a rocket, stop him. Stop him.
Do you know the reference that Ben is speaking about? Email us and we'll give you a prize.
Yes.
All right.
Or ridicule, whichever one suits our purpose for today.
Ridicule, most likely. We got no money. What are you talking about? We're going to do USB of the Week crazy in just a moment.
That was crazy. A beautiful
good said.
They're all the right words. Just put them in the right order.
Reorganize that, would you? Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is a weekly hour-long radio quiz program. Each week on the radio, you can test your knowledge against some of the best and brightest in the news and entertainment world while figuring out what's real news and what's made up. On the web, you can play along, too. That's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, today at noon, just an hour from now or so, and Sunday at 10 a.m. on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. I listen to Wait, Wait every week via podcast.
Yeah. When I'm driving back to Berkeley or farting back to Berkeley.
Great show. Geekspeak on KUSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. And the person we were talking about, hard drives recently, external hard drives, yeah, you can get them there too. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at kusp.org. Geekspeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used with permission. David Lawrence, of course, is the puppet master on Heroes, so now you know what it looks like. Anyway, I'm Lyle Troxell, in the air with me at Miles Elam and Ben Jaffe. And this is Al Luckow and his crazy USB of the Week. What do you got?
Hey, everybody. This is Al again. It's time for the crazy USB device of the week. This is where we scour the web and look for all the crazy things developers are doing with USB. Today, I'd like to tell you about the Pet Mini Digital Camera. This is a mini digital camera. It's rechargeable via USB and it easily attaches to your pet's collar and will then allow you to see what your furry little friend is up to when you're not around. What it does is take still photos that can be set at intervals of 1, 5, 15 minutes. It can take up to 40. They're 640 by 480 in resolution. I have one here, see, that I've attached to a cute little pooch to see what he's been up to. Let's take a look, shall we?
All right. This is my dog, Corky, actually.
Here he is. He's running in the backyard. That one. And then this is another one of him by a fence.
Aw.
Yes. Yeah, cute dog. Cute. Now he's looking at the sky and he's looks like, and this one he's turning around and now he's
Man.
Oh,
no.
Gross.
Man. Can we turn that off?
Yeah, that's enough of that.
This is a little bit more than it's possible that maybe you don't want to see everything that your dog is doing.
I'm just glad you didn't meet any other dogs.
Oh. I know. if anybody out there, if you run across these crazy USB things and you want to send it in, let us know and we'll look at them. A lot of them, these are, cheapo devices, plug into USB, get power that way. Just give us an email at
geekspeak.org. You just fill out a form. We'd love to hear about crazy USB of the Week stuff. Yeah. And that's how Al gets them, of course. And I'm sure, Al, you've got a plethora, right?
No, there's so many of them out there. It's ridiculous.
If you can plug it in, there's a USB solution for you. Car Talk is coming up next. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. And Car Talk on KSP is made possible by a grant from the Holly Family Fund at the Community Foundation of Santa Cruz County. And we appreciate their support. The Geeks today, Miles Elam, Ben Jaffe, Al Luckow. My name is Lyle Troxell, answering the phones as he does every week for years now. Rick Filman, quietly behind the scenes, making GeekSpeak work. Thank you very much, Rick. We appreciate your support. Next week, we're going to have a few shows, a show for you, of course, at 10 a.m. And I think Ben's lined up a few interesting ones. And you'll learn more about that next week when we come on air.